Final case today is case number 67597, Coastline Holdings versus Willen. Ms. Hanrod and Mr. Marquis. And also I'd like to acknowledge Lucy Crow, who's in the audience there. Lucy, would you stand up? Lucy's a graduate of Galena High School. She attends Boyd Law School and will be an extern for the Chief Justice starting this summer. Well, I forgot to ask you where your undergraduate was.
UNR.
Oh, okay. Judge Stiglitz and Justice Hart seem very happy that we have a Galena graduate coming here. Welcome to the Supreme Court. And are we ready? You want to reserve some time?
Yes, if I might.
Sure.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Joel Henriot on behalf of Coastline RE Holdings NB Corporation, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Pacific Western Bank. The district court erred in three conclusions of law, each of which independently require reversal. Let me first introduce those three, and then I'll go into more detail. The first, just as this court found in Munoz versus Branch Banking, NRS 40.459C, to the extent that it caps recovery by the amounts paid for a loan, is preempted by FIREA, the Financial Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act. So too, that extends to the assuming bank's use of its wholly owned subsidiaries as an instrumentality to collect on those. But even if it is not preempted, the statute as applied to this case, I think the statute was incorrectly applied when it comes to the court's erroneously narrow definition of the term consideration paid. First, I think consideration in the full face amount of the loan was paid by the wholly owned subsidiary. And two, if the district court is correct that the definition of consideration means that nothing was paid, well, then no amount was paid. And it wouldn't make sense to apply the statute to cap recovery if what we have is a donative transfer. Now, that's an alternative argument. I think consideration was paid. But any way you look at the statute, I think it's misapplied. And then we also have a contract clause issue. I think that the umbrella of preemption that is discussed in Munoz must extend to the bank's wholly owned subsidiary. In Munoz, this court recognized that the test for preemption and conflict preemption is twofold. One, does the state statute as applied frustrate Congress's purpose in the statute? And then the other is whether or not the application of the state statute impairs the efficiencies of the agencies. Well, here we have a problem on both counts. Because the FDIC, through its standard agreements, the purchase and assumption agreement, and the shared loss agreement, promulgates a uniform set of standards, of guidelines that the assuming banks work by to help the FDIC recover the greatest amounts possible in the loans of the failed banks. Here, that uniform framework expressly requires that the acquiring bank, here Pacific Western, uses its ordinary procedures to handle the acquired loans in the same way that it processes all of its other assets, as long as those are also industry standard. And that includes the use of wholly owned subsidiaries and other affiliates as instrumentalities to this is the very common practice, which is one of the reasons why the purchase and assumption agreement and the shared loss agreement both refer expressly to subsidiaries and the obligations to pay the FDIC for amounts recovered by the subsidiaries and the FDIC's promise to insure the loss up to 80% for losses that are incurred on the loan even after it has gone to the subsidiary.
Would your analysis, Mr. Henry, ought to be different if the bank were to enter into a contract with a non-subsidiary, a separate entity, to prosecute the resolution of the defaulted loan, and as part of that contract, either pay or receive different or separate consideration?
I think that it would be more complicated. I think that it might extend to that. I don't think that you get to that, but I think the limiting principle there would be.
So let's assume, for purposes of my question, that it isn't just a difficult question, it's a different question, but it's certainly something that could happen in commerce. Mm-hmm. How does one write an opinion in this case, extending the FIRA or FIRA protections to a subsidiary where there's been no consideration apparently paid versus the hypothetical I've tendered?
I think that as long as the obligations to and from the FDIC extend to the transaction, it would be covered. I think that if the bank were to use a third-party entity, and there are a different set of rules in the purchase and assumption agreement for third-party entities, but if the bank were to use that third party as an instrumentality, it still would be covered under FIREA. The terms of the purchase and sale agreement would trump the state statute as long as the insurance of the FDIC continues to guarantee amounts that are lost, and as long as amounts that are recovered by that third party entity must be passed on to the FDIC. Very roughly, I think that if we're talking about the FDIC's money, whether it is the FDIC paying the bank for the amounts lost or the FDIC's entitlement to recover what is subsequently obtained, then the terms of that purchase and sale agreement and the shared loss agreement must govern. Because Congress has given the FDIC sole discretion to come up with this framework for how banks that acquire assets through the FDIC are allowed to dispose of those assets, and how the FDIC's obligations to guarantee the 80% and the right recoveries are undertaken. So as long as, and I think here's what the opinion ought to say, as long as the FDIC's financial interest continues to be at issue, then I think that it would have to be preempted. Because otherwise, we are frustrating the purpose of the statute, which is to enhance recovery, and we are impeding the agency's efficient implementation of that statutory purpose. But I don't think we need to get there. I think that here we have a subsidiary that is expressly provided for an affiliate. I think that we could just say affiliate and subsidiary before we need to get to the question of third party recover. And certainly we are not a servicer of the loan. We're not a third party servicer. We are just, Coastline is just the instrumentality, actually the attorney in fact of Pacific Western. I am running out of time. The other point that this court makes in Munoz is that in addition to not allowing the state statute to frustrate Congress's purpose or impede the agency's efficient implementation, is going particularly to this statutory regime, the state statutory regime in Chapter 40. If that state statute makes it less likely that a rational creditor would purchase such a loan and make it more difficult to the FDIC to dispose of these assets, then it would have to be preempted. And I think that's exactly what we have here, no less than in Munoz. Because let me just take you back to how this works effectively. When a failed bank alerts the FDIC that it is about to fail, that can cause a panic very quickly. And so the FDIC puts out notice to healthy banks and solicits purchases and acquisitions of the failed bank. This happens within days, if not hours. And the acquiring bank doesn't have the opportunity to go through the loan portfolios and see in what jurisdictions are the real estate properties that are securing loans. The acquiring bank gets the portfolio of them all. Whatever liabilities and assets are behind the door of that failed bank. Now, if that acquiring institution has to be concerned that its routine practices of collection that are industry standard, that it uses across the board, are going to get it ensnared with particular peculiar state statutory regimes and impede recovery, then it will make that bank less likely to pick up the portfolio. And certainly, given the increased risk from that uncertainty, depress the amount that it's willing to pay.
Is any of your argument affected by the fact that after acquiring Affinity Bank's failed assets, Pacific Western, as I understand it, entered into a transaction with the borrowers and the guarantors to modify the loan? Did it become a new loan at that point?
I don't see why it would have, since it wasn't. I don't know that much about the refinancing, whether or not it was a formal refinance loan. I would be happy to look into that, and perhaps we could do supplemental briefing.
I'm not asking for that. Looking at your argument, I'm trying to test the boundaries of the point at which the FIREA preemption is extinguished and the statute might apply. And raising the question, the record shows there was a loan modification after this was acquired. Does that impact your analysis at all?
I don't know that it would. It might. It was not an issue that was raised at any time. Perhaps it could be remanded for findings on that. But I don't see that it would necessarily. Let me jump very quickly to consideration. I find nothing in Nevada law or anywhere else that limits the notion of contractual consideration to upfront payments in cash. And here the district court, I think, necessarily limited the definition of consideration to that narrow concept. Under Williston contract on contracts points out that it can be a contingent promise to pay in the future, which is exactly what we have here, an obligation to pass back anything that Coastline received to Pacific Western so that it could forward it to the FDIC, at least 80% of it. We also have the corresponding value to Pacific Western in the increased ownership or the increased value of its subsidiary in now taking this asset. And there certainly is nothing in the statute itself which puts anyone on notice or warns that consideration is limited to upfront cash payments. Now, I think that framework makes perfect sense in light of the intent of the legislature in enacting the statute, because they were going particularly to profiteering third parties who paid cash, pennies on the dollar, for loans, only to execute on them later and try to win the entire amount. So the framework makes sense in light of what the legislature intended. I think the district court, in defaulting to a position of no consideration because there was no cash payment, effectively got frustrated trying to put a round peg in a square hole. But I think that just goes to show that the statute was not intended for this type of situation. If there was consideration, it's for the full face value. If there isn't consideration and it's a donative transfer, then it wouldn't apply because there's no profiteering at issue. And I don't make a partial payment if I'm giving you nothing at all. It's preempted, but even if it's not, I think that the notion of consideration was misapplied.
Grab the binder, Justices.
Justices, good afternoon. Craig Marquis on behalf of respondents. We just heard from the petitioner essentially summarizing what the district court did in trying to put a round peg through a square hole fits. What we're seeing with the post-trial arguments, with the post-trial briefing, as well as with the additional attempted supplementation of issues on appeal, is what the case is really not about. This is a very limited issue with very limited application, and the court has the ability essentially to affirm the lower court's decision without going into the whole host for future cases because of its limited scope. This case is talking about a very limited period from 2011 after the enactment of AB 273 with its supplemental change in May of 2015. In May of 2015, 4490, the statute was amended to expressly limit it to residential properties under the primary residence. So it's taken it out of a commercial application and left it now in a residential application. Such arguments that were being sweeping, the sky is falling, banks are going to completely need to materially modify their arrangements, is completely erroneous. The banks would have already made modifications to the provisions and their operating procedures once the statute was enacted in May of 2015. So this, again, is a very limited issue. And first of all, the most important thing to take into consideration is that the district court properly applied the statute. The statute is not preempted. The issue that they've advanced in the petition is an argument that it frustrates the purpose of the FIRREA, the F-I-R-R-E-A, the Financial Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act. It does not. The state law at issue merely placed a limitation that if banks did not want to comply with Nevada law, they did not want to comply with formalities, that there would be consequences associated with that.
Can I ask you this, Mr. Marquis? On I looked at the dates. Judge Gonzalez entered your order in October 2014, and there was post-trial orders. The Munoz case came down in April of 2015, so Judge Gonzalez didn't have the benefit or whatever you would call it, of that opinion. So
yes.
Doesn't that change the playing field, the Munoz case, from where we were at in 2014 when the case was decided?
If this was an action that would have been brought directly by PWB, we would have had a different conversation today. It was not. This action was initiated by Coastline Reed, what was alleged to be a wholly owned subsidiary. What we don't have in this record, and what I think is very important for this court to understand when it's reconciling the record, is that you cannot take words in one statute in isolation and expect that you discount every other statute on the books that applies. In Nevada, there are rules and regulations governing corporate practices. Banks are not exempt. They have obligations to document their activities. We know from this record that there was no consideration paid by Coastline Re for this right to proceed with a deficiency action. And we know that based upon an admission that was contained in Coastline Re's opposition to the motion for summary judgment that was filed in the underlying action, record on appeal at page 195. And the basis for that was essentially because of the taxation standard. They said,
does it make a difference, if, like Justice Hardesty pointed out, if they're a wholly owned subsidiary versus what's called speculators out there buying stuff for pennies on the dollar and suing guarantors for the full face value? Isn't this a different situation here?
I would respectfully submit that it's the same situation, and I'll explain why in a few basic examples. In Justice Hardesty's example, we have a third party that's coming into a contractual relationship with a bank to specifically pursue collection. That is going to be documented by way of a formal agreement with consideration set forth as to what the nature of the party's relationship is. In a case where you have a wholly owned subsidiary that's created and no consideration is paid, for this limited window of case that we're talking about here today, the statute is expressly limited to the amount of consideration that was paid for the right to pursue the action. In Justice Hardesty's example, a separate entity will have paid some consideration. Therefore, they have a basis to say, fair market value of the property less what we paid, there is a quantifiable amount of consideration that would apply for this statute, and you can determine the appropriate amount of a deficiency judgment. In a case like this, where you have a wholly owned subsidiary, they're claiming that they made an accounting transfer for strictly taxation purposes. No corporate documents, no corporate formalities, no consideration paid. Therefore, as the lower court properly interpreted, when there's no consideration that's been paid, we cannot determine whether the fair market value of the property exceeded what was paid or was less than what was paid, justifying an amount of a deficiency. The key here also to keep in mind is that when we look at these two agreements that they are now advocating that somehow gives them these post-trial rights as an affiliate, which wasn't argued, when you actually look at the purchase and assumption agreement and you also look at the commercial shared loss agreement, the definition, although the shared loss agreement does reference an affiliate definition, it expressly interprets that as being in accordance with the definition of the purchase and assumption agreement, and it expressly defines it as a person. When you actually go to that definition of person, right, Record of Appeal at 221, it expressly excludes corporation. The corporation, under the purchase and assumption agreement and the commercial shared loss agreement, is the bank. So, the argument that they're advancing that they are now an affiliate or they are a wholly owned subsidiary and the rights of the FIRREA extend to them is a complete misstatement of the law. That is why, going back to the question with respect to Munoz, it's a different issue. Because in Munoz, the underlying action was initiated by BB&T. They were a direct assignee, if you will, or transferee of the obligation from the FDIC to pursue collection. This is a case where you have a subsequent transferee with no consideration having been paid. Based upon that, Munoz doesn't apply, the preemption doesn't apply, and the frustration argument similarly doesn't apply. Because to rule that this statute somehow frustrated this bank's practices in a very limited window would mean that you completely disregard the issue which other Nevada laws directly relate to, preventing the formation of shell entities or fraudulent conveyances between parties. The mere fact that there was no consideration puts this case squarely within the statute. There was no consideration that was paid. The next argument that they advance with respect to this issue is that, well, the court misinterpreted it because a promise to pay in the future could be deemed consideration. They're overlooking the fact that there were repeated opportunities to actually present information in this case as to what consideration, if any, was paid. We know from the summary judgment opposition, they paid none. We asked discovery responses in this case. The interrogatory request in particular, interrogatory number 3, on Record on Appeal at 496, asked them specifically, what consideration did Coastline Re pay for the right? The response was, PWB paid, and here's our shared loss agreement. It shows this one line item that was not redacted, with all of the other entries being redacted. And this goes to the very point of the issue of consideration. When the FDIC is in the position of taking over a bank's assets because that bank is failing, They know well in advance of that failure. The Nevada Financial Institutions Division are constantly going in, along with FDIC representatives, to banking institutions. They're running audits constantly. The bank is reporting on their status financially. This is information that is tracked and known. But when the bank is in a position of failing, and the FDIC steps in and comes up with a pool of assets, they take, because they're obligated under federal law, the full value of those failed bank's assets. They put them through a purchase and assumption agreement, but they give them to the assigned or the acquiring bank discount. The problem that we have is that if it's given at a discount, why those numbers are all redacted from the record is because the bank never wants to disclose how much it actually paid or had allocated for any particular asset. This goes to the very concern of this court in the Sandpoint decision, and in particular, Justice Cherry and Perigary's concerns in the dissent, where you're talking about conduct and profiteering, and the very legislative history was to preclude that very thing. But when you have a bank that's not disclosing that information, and you have them now trying to go forward and collect a deficiency, and you have a record like we have in this case, where PWB expressly refused to negotiate. They wanted nothing to do with one of the individual defendants in the underlying action, Mr. LaMarca. The record is replete. They had an animus towards him. They wanted to basically do everything they could do to push this aside. Those concerns of profiteering, when you have undisclosed values and you have conduct on the part of banks that are trying to get everything and circumventing the statutes, goes to the very heart of why the lower court's decision in this case was completely correct. The statute is not preempted, it does apply. And most importantly, the mere fact that they failed to introduce any consideration, any evidence at all in this record, other than their attempt post-trial and post-briefing to suggest otherwise.
Counsel, doesn't the absence of consideration support the argument that ERA extends to a subsidiary that is paid none? The point of the Munoz decision, as I understand it, was to say that there's the preemption doctrine applies because there would be a frustration of the FDIC goal if there hasn't been consideration paid, simply an assignment of the deed of trust to a subsidiary, that it would seem to me that that would underscore the concern that the collection of this is otherwise a frustration of the FIRA mandate.
Justice Hardesty, I come back to the point that respectfully I don't believe that it is a frustration, and I'll give you two reasons why. First and foremost, in Munoz, you had a direct action that was being prosecuted by the bank that was contractually obligated under the PAA and the SLA with the FDIC. Here, you have a subsequent transferee that is not a contracting party. While PWB may still be obligated under the agreements with the FDIC, there's no contractual right. In fact, the actual shared loss agreement excludes any rights to successors, and it prohibits the application of third-party beneficiaries. That's the record on appeal at 252. Based upon that, a subsequent transferee or a wholly owned subsidiary who is paid no consideration is not a contracting party to those agreements, has no rights as a matter of law, and by the very agreements that they're attempting to articulate.
Let me say, I understand your agreement. Perhaps you and Mr. Henry ought to be saying the same thing. The parameters around which FIRA extends are governed by the agreement between the bank and the FDIC. So if affiliate is defined in one particular way and this arrangement doesn't fit that definition, FIRA shouldn't apply. On the other hand, had it included subsidiaries, it would apply.
That would be the argument, yes, Justice Hardesty, and I would agree with you in that interpretation. And here we know from this record, the underlying bank cannot take advantage of that argument because they never made the underlying record in this case to suggest that they were an affiliate with rights or that they were somehow a subsidiary with rights under those agreements. They took it at face value. We're the assignee. We're pursuing this. And when they were pushed to the question to actually present evidence of any consideration, none was ever provided despite multiple opportunities throughout the underlying case. So therefore, they cannot pursue it. And because of the separation of the relationship between the FDIC and this purported wholly owned subsidiary, there is no issue with respect to extending or frustrating FERIA.
Is Judge Dew's analysis of this issue in Eagle helpful, given the fact that it didn't take into account Munoz?
That is a difficult question. I know as the state court, we have the right to look to federal courts for guidance or assistance, not having precedential value, but at least for guidance. And I think that when you look at this Munoz decision and its implication, again, it's a very limited application in a very limited environment dealing with commercial property transactions between that 2011 enactment period to 2015 when it was changed. And when you look at the decisions with respect to the frustration, you have to look, obviously, I think part of that other case addressed the issue of when the underlying transfer occurred and whether or not the deficiency was post-application of statute versus pre-application of statute. So, again, I may have just one 30-second opportunity just to summarize. Essentially, the argument that we did not get to, that they did advance, or at least raise, and I'm sure Mr. Enriod will address here in his concluding comments, addresses the issue of the contract clause in just 30 seconds or less. The contract clause, Article 1, Section 10, is not implicated in any way, shape, or form, first of all, because Coastline Re is not a contracting party to that underlying group of agreements, the purchase and assumption agreement and the commercial shared loss agreement. Therefore, there's no frustration, and the assignment that is at issue and the actual transaction that is at issue is not the pre-existing contractual relationship between PWB getting the underlying documents and the transfer of the property from the FDIC. What the issue is in this case is Coastline Re's acquisition of those assets, which obviously in the sale which occurred after the underlying is applied, so there's no frustration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll give you 2 minutes to sum up.
On this issue of waiver and the allegation that we raised many of these arguments for the first time post-judgment, I really think it's baseless. I invite the court to look in our reply brief where we set out exactly where in the district court at trial, in the evidence that was admitted, in the testimony in particular of Jeff Goddard, who was the vice president of Pacific Western Bank and the president of Coastline, the form of the consideration, the form of the transfer of the asset, we admitted into evidence the assignment itself. So this idea that we are coming up with this post-judgment simply isn't true. And trial counsel argued to the district court in closing about how the statute was preempted in this case because of our position as an affiliate of Pacific Western Bank under the purchase and assumption agreement and as a subsidiary. And the district court found that we are a wholly owned subsidiary. And as a matter of definition under the contracts, that makes us an affiliate. we did not disclose the value of the amount that Pacific Western paid. I understand it is frustrating that we, to some, that we may not be able to pinpoint a dollar amount that was paid from which that you could allocate from our bid for the entire bank that would have gone to the particular loan. That's not the way it works. That's not the way the FDIC requires it, which is why state statutes like this that require oversimplification shouldn't stand in the way of the FDIC doing its job.
Thank you. Well, thanks both counsel for your arguments and the briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted and we'll be in recess until tomorrow morning.